This is Graham. He's new to PokerStars. Graham doesn't know it yet, but he's a VIP. He's entitled to claim points against any number of rewards in the PokerStars VIP program. From PlayStations to plasmas, from Porsches to seats at major on- and offline poker tournaments. You see, he started collecting VIP points the minute he joined PokerStars as a real money player. Because we don't think you should have to apply or be in the know to earn rewards. He'll be very excited when he finds out. Just you wait and see. Wait for it. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP and find out why all other reward schemes seem just a little, well, inaccessible. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Annie Up PokerCast presented by PokerStars. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's November 6th, 2009, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the internet. I am Chris Cosenza.
And I am Scott Long. Happy Halloween, Chris.
You too, buddy. Belated, but, you know, I saw a picture of you, and you looked kind of awesome in your costume.
Kind of awesome, I'll tell you. I'll take that. Thank you. Appreciate it. You know, I never get dressed up for Halloween since I was a kid, and I've always kind of wanted to, and then this year, of course, you know, I happened to be playing in a tournament on Halloween, and they had a costume party that night contest, which sadly I didn't stick around for because the tournament didn't go that well. Right. But, you know, I ordered a big old $100 bill costume because that's the buy-in down here in Florida. I had a little fun with the sign on it, and I thought I was clever.
You were, right?
I think you thought I was clever. Yeah. A couple other people said I was clever. But, you know, so I walk into the tournament on Saturday, Halloween, right? And, you know, all the cocktail waitresses are dressed up, and all of them are in, like, these really hot police uniform kind of things. Woo! Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the dealers are dressed up. And, but I'm walking through, and I'm like, am I the only dork that doesn't work there that wore a costume on Halloween to this tournament? I mean, it's called the Halloween tournament.
Exactly.
And, you know, I'm talking to a guy right before the tournament, and, you know, we're talking about the tournament coming up, and he's like, wow, looks like we're the only two who dressed up. And I looked at the guy, and I'm like, oh.
Oh, my God.
Apparently, he must have dressed up, too. I don't really know what he was. I mean, he was wearing some kind of leisure suit, so, you know, if you want to try to pull off the Ralph Furley look, you don't want to go to a track where everybody kind of looks like that, you know? But I sit down at my table and get ready. The tournament starts, and the guy next to me goes, "Are you trying to sell something?" And I'm like, "No, it's Halloween." He's like, "Oh yeah, it is Halloween."
Oh, are you kidding me?
All right, I get it. You know, because it looks like there's a big sandwich board or something on there, and trying to get somebody to buy a timeshare or something. I don't know. But I'm like, "Whew." All right, boy, you can tell when people play poker so much, they don't even know what the date is anymore. But it gets better, Chris. We're playing, we're in a couple rounds, and we had a dealer sit down, and he's dressed like kind of like Bob Marley. You know, he's got the whole Jamaican kind of Rastafari kind of look.
Yeah, yeah.
Dreadlocks and stuff. Hey, it was pretty good. He pulled it off, right? So after his down is over, he gets up and moves on, and the next dealer sits down. And the same guy that asked me, Chris, what the hell I was wearing, turns to the new dealer who's not in costume and goes, "Hey, is that guy over there really a dealer?" And the new dealer's like, yeah. He's like, because he's not dressed like one. And the dealer's like, it's Halloween. He's like, oh, yeah, you're right, it is. And I'm looking at this guy, and I'm like, seriously? In 1 hour, you've forgotten that it's Halloween after you've already did the same thing to me.
Oh, man.
But, you know, his cluelessness continued with his play, and so we've got a couple interesting things here that I think the nation will want to chew their teeth on here.
Well, wait, let me tell you my Halloween story real quick before.
Oh, okay,
before,
great. Before. Yeah, sure.
So, of course, you know, my wife was doing the 3-day walk, and right. That night.
Breast cancer.
Yeah,
very good.
Yeah, exactly. And so that night, I come home to give away candy, and I open the door, and there's this kid at the door, and he's dressed like a normal kid. And I said, what are you doing? And he's like,
what are you doing?
He's like, trick or treat. And I said, what's your costume? And he says, I'm a student. And I said, okay, well, here's your first lesson. Get dressed up for Halloween or you're not going to get candy from me. And I closed the door.
Oh, man. So let me ask you, Chris, how long did it take you to wash the egg off?
I opened the door and said, all right, just kidding. Have a Twix, you lazy bum. I couldn't believe it. How lazy, you know, that's the deal. You get dressed up, you get candy. You don't get dressed up, you don't get candy.
You know, you can just grab a mask out of the closet or something. It doesn't have to be too elaborate, but yeah, you're right. You know, grabbing a pillowcase and running around the neighborhood does not qualify.
Just rub some dirt on your face and say you're Ted Kaczynski. I don't care.
Absolutely. Very good. Very good. I like it.
Just come to the door looking different than yourself. But anyway, go on with your story. I just had to tell that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, the clueless guy, he made this move twice, Chris. All right. Probably second or third level. He pushes all in for the 6,000 when the blinds are like 100, 200. All right. Have you seen this play before?
Oh, of course.
And I just think it's terrible, personally. All right. I'm obviously a different player than the folks that pull this off, but I just don't like it because I think bad things can happen with it.
Sure, you can only get called by a better hand unless
you
have aces.
I mean, the upside is very low. The downside is very high. It just doesn't make sense to me, right?
Right.
But he did it once and got away with it. The second time he did it, it folded around to a woman on the other side of the table who thought for a while and called him, Chris, with queen five of clubs.
Awesome.
All right, so the hands are turned over. This guy had ace queen.
Oh.
And starts murmuring, oh. How could she call that? of course, she spikes a five, and he is on fumes now. And for the next 47 days after this, he would not shut up about how this woman, how could she call that? That's terrible. All right, now, I can't argue with him on that. I don't think. Maybe you can. I can't.
No, I can't argue with the call, but I can definitely argue with him.
What I wanted to say to him, and I was trying not to get into a fight because I was wearing a big $100 bill, is, you know, if you're going to make that kind of crazy move, that's what's going to happen to you.
Exactly. What was he hoping? That every time he did it, they'd fold?
Push that much.
Exactly.
So, so the lesson out there to all you kids listening, you know, this massive, massive overbet. If you think you're going to get cute with it, just understand what's going to happen if somebody calls you.
And
do not whine about it because, you know, had she not spiked that five, I'm sure he would have been walking around, you know, beating his chest, talking about how cool he was.
Oh, man.
But anyhow, you know, I was playing really well, actually. I chipped up early, which is unlike me. And, you know, I thought I was going to make a run in this tournament. It turned out it was $26,000 for first price in this.
Wow.
$26,000.
Wow.
That's like more than I made in my entire life.
It's definitely more than I made.
And so I shipped up and I was doing well until this happened, Chris, and it rattled me. And I admit right now I need to be a better player to get over being rattled. But this is what happened. I was playing against a woman who, she's not a bad player, but she's not a really crafty player.
Uh-huh.
Kind of an ABC type of player, right? But she was playing well. She had a lot of chips. All right, I had ace-8. I made a button raise, and she called me. All right? Flop came 9-8-5, I believe. All right? So I bet out. She calls. All right? The turn was another card that wasn't really material to the situation right now. I made another bet. All right, she goes to call me, Chris, but she picks up a stack of chips and takes it across the line.
Oh, I hate that.
And drops her call in, right? All right, now we've seen this happen before, and sometimes it's a ploy. You know, the guy's got, like, quads.
Yeah.
But to go, oops, I'm sorry, I didn't realize, and then you move all in, and he crushes your dreams, right?
Yeah.
I could tell that this woman really accidentally did this. All right, and she felt bad about it. But of course the dealer, because he's a good dealer, said, I'm sorry, those chips have to stay in play. And she said, fine. So everything is cool right now. But now it gets back to me, Chris. Now what do you do? I've got a hand that is not great. I mean, second pair top kicker.
Yeah.
With a woman who was willing to call me. But now she's put in a fairly significant raise. Do you fold now? Do you shove? Do you just call? I don't know.
Oh, my God. That sucks.
I mean, when I retold the story to some other people, I just explained it to it as it's an unfortunate situation. I didn't do anything wrong. She accidentally did something wrong. The dealer enforced the rule correctly. But I'm really the one that's paying the price here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, did she have enough chips behind where she could fold if you did something like shove?
Oh, yeah. She was probably the chip leader at the table.
Wow. Maybe I do shove then.
So my immediate thought is to shove. But yeah. Two reasons I didn't want to shove. One, she had enough chips that she could have called me. Two, I didn't really like my hand that much. And three, and this is probably the weakest argument, you know, I kind of like to be a nice guy at the table, and I don't want to like – again, I could tell this woman accidentally did this. It wasn't like a 50-50, maybe she's trying to make a move.
Yeah.
So to push all in, you know, then I'm double punishing her, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, I don't think I would mind that if I had a stronger hand. I probably would have shoved. But and I didn't think I could fold because I thought I had the best hand at the time. So what did I do? I split the middle and called. The absolute worst thing to do.
Oh, you called. Oh, no.
The absolute worst thing to do, right?
Oh, man. Yeah, I don't do that.
Well, and then the river came another nine. I had checked at that point. The woman very nicely said, all right, I think I've taken enough of your chips. She checks behind. She had a nine.
Oh.
So I was beat from the flop, and, of course, she improved in the end. It was very nice to me not to put a bet in. She should have really value bet.
See, your karma. Your karma there. You know, it came back for you. You know, you were nice in the hand, and she checked it down for you at the end. And so karma. So that's good. At least there's a happy ending.
Yeah, but I lost a good chunk of my stack on that crazy hand. I mean, there's lots of things that maybe I don't make that button raise with ace-8, but I don't think that's that bad.
Yeah.
You know, obviously I should have shoved. But, you know, she's got top pair, and I forget what her kicker was. Actually, I think it was the ace, actually. So she had top pair, top kicker. So if I shove, I got to think that she's going to call me there, right?
Yeah, Yeah, I don't think – I think I'd chicken out and don't shove. Not because in the end that she had the better hand, and I know that now. But I think in the end I'd probably chicken out and shove and just fold. Just because she could have been – there is the 50% chance that she is making a move like that. And there's the other chance that she does have a better hand. That's why she's calling me, but she's not real happy with it. And then there's also a chance of her sucking out on me too. So maybe I do end up just folding. I don't think I could ever call there, though. It's either shove or fold.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
where were you then?
I'm sorry, buddy.
Out there walking, making money, trying to prevent breast cancer. Yeah. These days, and I'm in need.
You know what's even more shocking is that we're like 15 minutes into the show and we're still on the first item to talk about. This is going to be a landmark episode, I think.
All right, well, the World Series is coming up, Chris. It starts tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Saturday. And continues on until Monday night. And later on the main topic, we got your great interview with Kevin Schaffel from Coral Gables.
Coral Springs.
Coral Springs.
Yeah, yeah.
Sounds better than Coral Gables.
It does sound nicer, doesn't it? It sounds like a nice, happy place where you can stay young the rest of your life.
Oh, excellent. So look forward to that interview. And but, you know, obviously we're Andy Epps Florida Poker Magazine, so we're pulling for our good friend Kevin here.
Yep.
Even though he's six in chips. And Casino City Times put out a call. They wanted predictions from pros and the media. And, of course, I'm not going to turn down free publicity, right?
No, absolutely.
So I set them off my picks, and they published them. We'll put the link in the forum at andyupmagazine.com/forum. But you can also see it at Casino City Times. And they got a fairly decent response from some big pros and some big other media folks. And, Chris, I'm the only one that said Kevin Schaffel will win this thing.
Good for you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hey, you know what? That is not a bad pick at all.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And not just because you're my business partner. I mean, really, this he knows how to play. He knows how to go deep. He's just coming off a second place finish at the Legends main event. And you know what? He could scoot in under the radar, and just like Peter Eastgate did last year, for half the show, you didn't even know he was there. Then bingo, bango, bongo, he's the final table, final two, wins it. So, you know what? I can see the other guys tearing each other apart, and Schaffel just making his way through the field and getting heads up, and I think he could do it.
Well, good. Well, we'll see. What they asked us for was who we thought we'd win, who we thought would finish second, and I love this, if Phil Ivey is not one of those two people, where do we think he's going to finish? So I picked Darman Moon for second.
Ah.
And my point was that it's going to take a lot of skill to donk off 59 million chips. And I really believe that. I mean, that's, you know, I know other people are saying, you know, if you compare their chip stacks to people, you know, it's really not that big of a lead. But I'm sorry, 59 million, that's a lot of chips.
Well, here's the thing, Scott, and I know you don't watch a lot of the poker on television, and I know a lot, and you and I are the first ones to stand in line and tell everybody, you know, don't believe what you see on TV because they only show the best hands. But this guy, I mean, he literally should have two black guys and like stitches on his forehead for how many times he's gotten hit in the head with a deck. It's unbelievable, and that's all he talks about too. When anybody actually gets him to talk, and I like this guy a lot. He's a very nice guy. He's very quiet, very reserved. I really like Darvin Moon a lot. But he'll be the first one to tell you, man, it's just that's how it's been. If I don't have the best cards, I get what I need on the flop. If I have the best cards, they have the second best cards, and they get all their chips. He really just got crushed, and I just wonder what's going to happen if he gets to that table and runs cold just a little bit and doubles one person through and takes a chip lead. Because that's really all he has to do. I mean, look how fast last year when Dennis Phillips had a massive chip lead, and really two hands in, he didn't have a chip lead anymore. So, and was in danger of going out like a few hands later. So it could happen. I mean, he could really go down. I don't know who's going to win this thing, but I really think this is one of the first years where really anybody could win.
Interesting. Well, the consensus pick seems to be Eric Buchman?
Oh, Buchman. Yeah, Eric Buchman.
Which is not a bad pick. I mean, he's, what, second in chips.
Yeah.
And, you know, a very good pro. But Phil Ivey, of course, got a lot of love.
Oh, yeah.
And I really had trouble picking where I think Phil's going to go. I mean, because there's so many variables with him here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's either one or the other. Either he's going to have to make a move fairly early, and if he wins that move, he's probably going to win the thing. Yeah. And if he loses it, then he's going to be out pretty quickly. So, you know, I think I ended up splitting the difference and said he'll finish fifth. But, you know, I think it's impossible to handicap where Phil Ivey's going to finish.
No, I totally agree because he's the type of player that either wants to go big or go home and play golf. So, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. I think he's going to find a hand and try to outplay somebody. And unless it goes his way, he's going to go out early or he's going to double up and everyone's going to be afraid of him. And then that's it. He's just going to start eating away until he wins it. So you're right. I think it's either going to be first or like eighth, you know, and then you have to pick the average. So fifth or fourth is probably a good pick. But yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that it's impossible to pick where he's going to end up if he doesn't win.
Well, and we've talked a lot about Darvin Moon already on the show now, but our good friends Lon McCarron and Norman Chad, they were on the World Series of Poker conference call last week. They said that if Darvin Moon wins this, Chris, we will see another resurgence of poker along the lines of when Chris Moneymaker won.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I think poker is really big, and anyone who was going to get in got in. I don't think it's going to be like, hey, a logger from Maryland can win, I can win. No, because they've already figured, hey, if an accountant from Tennessee can win, I can win. I don't think that there's that many people out there that are still on the fence about whether or not they should play and see a logger win it all and say, okay, I should play now. I think it's beyond that. I don't buy into that. If I was on the Around the Horn show on ESPN, I would sell.
I would sell. Excellent. I mean, I think trying to compare this to Chris Moneymaker is just, I don't know what the word is. I mean, I don't want Norman to deny me a paps when we get together, so I'll be nice here. But certainly if he wins, though, I mean, I think it's going to get a little more attention in the mainstream media. I mean, the poker media, I don't think really is going to care so much now.
Right.
But, you know, if somebody like, you know, Eric Buchman wins, I don't think you're going to get a lot of press in the mainstream media You know, the only two people that can win that I think are going to do that are Phil Ivey or Darvin Moon. So, of course, Darvin Moon is going to be a much bigger story for the mainstream media because they're going to like, hey, some unknown that has no idea what he's doing.
Yeah.
Won again. So I think it gets more press. So I think there might be a bump, but to compare it to the Moneymaker effect,
yeah, I don't think so.
Overstated.
I don't think so. You know, one place where you can make your mark is, of course, in Apes. If you want a lot of media coverage, you got to win an Apes event. You will be known around the world, at least in more than 30 countries, as a banana holder. And hopefully we'll get it right this time with our Heads Up No Limit Hold'em on November 11th, this Wednesday. And, you know, we've talked to the support so much now, we're on like a first-name basis. Isn't that true?
That's true. And, you know, I sent him an email this week. Was really two points. One, you know, I acknowledged that they got flooded from emails from our listeners after the free roll, and I just wanted to let them know that we really want them to pay close attention to the Apes event, and if there are dead stacks facing off each other, to really enforce that 250 hand policy that they seem to have, and keep this thing moving along, because no one wants to be playing this thing until 4 or 5 in the morning. And then also, it sounded, unfortunately, you know, they're trying to come back to the free roll and trying to rectify it in the past, and unfortunately, a couple of our listeners got caught in the net there and are having some problems logging in. So we want to be sure that we're trying to do all we can to help the listeners out with that as well, too. But I'm really looking forward to the Heads Up. I like the format, and you know, hopefully there'll be good monitoring of it, and it will move along briskly. And, I mean, because it's a unique event. I mean, I'm really looking forward to it.
Me too, absolutely. I mean, I won a couple of, you know, matches, and it was, you know, 3 a.m. So I just couldn't focus anymore. But I'd like to see what it's like when I know I only have to win, like, 6 matches to win the whole thing, or 5 matches and be coherent. So I'm really looking forward to it. And, you know, if I go out in the first one, I go out in the first one. That's the beauty of Heads Up. That's just the way it goes sometimes. So
yeah, you're just going to cash tables and crush it, right?
No, out with me. I don't have any money online. So I won't be doing that this time.
you're just to wait for your play money to arrive.
Yeah, that's what it is. Or I'll borrow some money from you. But other than that, yeah, I'll just be watching. Oh, man. All right, so our hotline's ringing. 813-448-1120. We like this hotline because if you call it and leave a message, it not only helps us fill the show, but it helps us give away stuff. So if you do it and we use it, we'll give you something really cool. This one comes from Jeram from Cincinnati.
I heard about a recent WPT event where apparently a couple guys, as things got down the bubble, made what's called like a saber arrangement. I never heard of that. They were on separate tables, and they were both really short-stacked. And they basically agreed that if either one of them went out early, then whoever made the money, they would split, or they would offer each other some sort of share, which definitely obviously has ethical consequences, and I think could probably change the play. But I never heard of that. I don't know if you guys ever heard of that. I thought you'd maybe comment on that and you know, some of the ramifications of such an agreement as you guys see it.
Jerem, here's the thing. A lot of pros do these saves. I mean, it's a way of kind of mitigating the variance in tournaments.
Yeah. Yeah.
And generally speaking, I think when you get to a final table or something, most people will let you know, who's got action on each other. And I think we've seen that before, right? There was a thing, I seem to remember a WPT event where two players that had action on each other.
Would you like to know what it was?
I would, thank
you. It was Hassan Habib!
Yes, that's right!
And Tuan Lee. Those two guys had acted on each other, and they were at the final table. And it was like the big one, too, like the World Poker Tour World Championship. And they had each other's, or either it was Hassan Habib had his action, you know, he'd put him in, or they had each other's action. But they did let everybody know ahead of time, hey, you know, we've got a piece of each other, and don't worry, we'll be playing each other just as hard as we can. And that's the way to do it. If you don't do that, you're totally unethical, and really, you risk a lot of damage.
All right. But, you know, I kind of feel where Jeremy's coming from, that, you know, it does seem a little unethical, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That, you know, you've got players, and you know, it's not like you got, like, a sign on you the entire tournament. Hi. You know, Chris Cosenza's got 10% of me. Mike Basso's got 20% of me. I mean,
yeah.
if you don't know it, then it's unfortunate. But I understand why it's done, and it doesn't necessarily make it right, I guess, though. So
yeah,
Laz is going to kick my butt because I'm being wishy-washy here.
Oh, my God. All right, well, tell him what he won.
All right, I'm excited. We got a brand new item on the swag shelf. Jerem, send us your address to podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we will set you out a setup of J-Design playing cards from classicplayingcards.com. These are the official playing cards of Anti-Up. Jason, the founder, went on a cruise. He's a great guy, and you get the magazine, you've seen these cards in those, and we're happy that we have them on the swag shelf now.
Yeah, they're sweet. And, you know, they're also the official cards of the Cosenza mom and dad home game. So,
ooh, very important, very important.
So, you know, that's prestigious right there. All right, Scott, what do you got piling up on the NEUP news desk?
All right. World Poker Tour Enterprises stockholders on Monday overwhelmingly approved a $12 million cash purchase from party gaming subsidiary Peerless Media, spurning a late $36 million offer from Mandalay Media that was deemed, quote, not superior.
You know, I can't keep track of it now. It's like the 17th company that's made a bid to buy the... It's like, oh my God, here's this company that's like belly up forever, can't make a dime, and people are standing in line to try to buy it. It's like, okay, let's just get it. Let somebody buy it before they figure out that, you know, there's the guy behind the curtain pulling all the... You know, just get it over with. Jeez.
Well, yeah, it does look like it's over with now. I mean, obviously, you know, in these kind of purchases, until it's actually closed, I mean, there could be another offer that comes around. And but yeah, I mean, they have to have a lot of stockholders have to have a lot of faith in Party Gaming, which obviously is a very large, stable company. But to take that offer over, you know, Mandalay Media was interesting to see.
Wow. Well, the long, nightmarish run of Maria Ho and Tiffany Michelle on CBS's reality show The Amazing Race has finally ended after the poker pros quit when they couldn't finish either of the two challenges required to advance.
Chris, this was so sad. And when I say this was so sad, I mean from back in L.A. when Phil goes, on your mark, set, go. From that period on... It was like Keystone Cops for these two poker pros. I think we talked about this on the show, Chris, but they finished last, but it was a non-elimination round, so they stay in.
Yeah.
They finished last again, and some dorks lose their passports and get eliminated, so they stay in.
That's like back-to-back one-outers.
It was terrible, and then they get to this challenge where they have to choose one of two things. Either they got to swim across the river and play this kind of Dutch golf, which admittedly looked really difficult, or they had to go dance. But in order to get into the dance, they had to like do one of those little, you know, strongman where you hit the little button and the little thing goes up and hits a bell.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they tried it 100 times, at least, because they had a little counter, and they couldn't get it.
Oh, no way.
And it was just sad, and then they finally just said, hey, we quit. They quit, Chris.
They quit.
I mean, at that point, they were out of it anyhow, so, I mean, it's kind of immaterial. But the fact that they just picked up the Amazing Race phone and said, we're out.
Wow, you got to be kidding me. Now, you just know, too, going in that Tiffany Michelle thought that they were just going to win this thing hands down, and you could just tell that's the way they were thinking when they got there. But as soon as they got there and reality hit them that they're in these, like, third world countries or whatever, that things were not going to turn out the way they thought.
Yeah, it was just, well, you know, I feel bad for anybody that has that kind of problem, but I certainly, it doesn't speak highly of poker player skills, watching these guys bubble around. And finally, Chris, Kara Scott has been confirmed as AJ Benz's replacement as co-host of High Stakes Poker. Scott, previously the host of Poker Night Live and a poker columnist, has recently posted some deep runs in major tournaments.
I'm gonna plead the fifth here and not say anything.
I figured you might.
Yeah, I'm not gonna say anything.
You don't want AJ to go off on you.
No, it's not even that. You know, I just I'm gonna reserve judgment until I see what goes on. But again, I just don't think that whatever they had will ever be matched again, and we'll see what happens.
That's true, but I have heard online that there's a lot of respect for Kara Scott.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Podcasting community. So you know, we'll feel bad about our buddy AJ not being on anymore, but at least they pick somebody that seems to be capable.
Yeah, absolutely. She's definitely top-notch, but like I said, I just don't know about the whole way it's going to be done now. I can't wait to see what happens. All right, well, I know we have a letter from the mailbag, and why don't you read it, because you're on a roll.
All right, this comes from Len Miller in Haverton, Pennsylvania. Haverton or Haverton?
You know what? I'm not even going to guess.
You know, at this point, you would think that people would just give me a pronunciation guide for any stuff, even words as easy as is.
I'm going to go on a limb and say Haverton, but it, Haverton, could, be, but right. It could be Haverton. That's the beauty of the English language. It's terrible.
All right, Len, wherever you are from in the great state of Pennsylvania, we appreciate you sending in this letter. And you say, I play online in low-limit house games and in a bar league. I play in the bar league 3 times in the last 5 or 6 weeks. Each time I finished in 10th place out of between 42 and 50 players. All right, he's getting deep.
Yeah.
Each time he was a short stack when we made the points, it seems I play well, in parentheses tight,
yeah,
enough to make it to the points, but can't survive the blinds once I get there. What could I do to give myself a better chance once I near the final table? Also, as tight as I play, I'm wondering if I'm playing enough hands. I almost always play nothing but premium hands and almost never try to bluff. How many hands should someone play when playing a multi-table tournament?
Wow.
Wow,
there's a lot of questions there. Oh, man. Well, you know, I think a lot of people will always tell you that when it gets close to the points or close to the bubble, if you have a decent stack, that point is when you want to start pressing people, especially in position, and trying to force them to decisions where they don't want to go out and you have a bigger stack, so you pick on the medium stacks. That's the kind of thing that you would do. Now, in a free league, a lot of times the pressure is not really there because they're just playing for points and they're not playing for big money or anything, so it's tough to know how they'll react at being so far removed from it. You know, years ago I tried those, but you know, as far as that is concerned, I mean, I think the best way to do it is to either change the way you're playing early on in the tournament, try to accumulate a lot of chips, you know, by being really aggressive when you're in position and exposing people for what, you know, what kind of players they are, or just hope you have a big stack when it gets to that point and then try to abuse the middle stacks. But the other stuff, you know, we could definitely share on giving advice here.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wrote him and I said, you know, if he never tries to bluff, then he's kind of like a three-legged stool.
Yeah.
I mean, bluffing is definitely part of the game. And at some point, you've got to not worry what your cards are and put it out there, make other players fold better hands. So that's definitely something you got to do. And particularly, I think, when you get down towards that end, that's probably what happens is if you're playing nothing but premium cards, you know, you're dependent on premium cards being dealt to you.
Yeah.
And at some point, you got to have. You can't count on that, but you can always count on the fact that you can bet. And so, yeah, you definitely need to work in some bluffs there, and you know, not get too loose with your hands. I mean, being tight is not bad, but.
And he's the perfect. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, he's the perfect candidate for bluffing too, because he
exactly.
Everyone knows now that he only plays premium hands, so now he can go there and say, "All right, I haven't gotten a good hand in a while. I need to take some blinds down here to survive a couple more rounds. Let me represent the hands that I always represent when I actually do play them." So, I mean, he's the perfect candidate to bluff people and to get some extra rounds. So he should take advantage of that table image.
Yeah, I would think. I guess my suggestion is if he normally finishes 10th out of 50, when you get down to about 15 players or so, is when you need to reassess where you are and start to shift gears and get a little more crazy.
And then the last thing he says is, how many hands should someone play when playing a multi-table tournament? And this really can't be answered. I mean,
well, yeah, I can. I play every hand, actually.
Well, you play every hand, but I think he means how many times you want to enter the pot.
Oh, okay, all right, yeah. Because, you know, if you're not looking at your cards and just fucking, that's bad. You should always look at your cards.
But, you know, a lot of people, they'll throw out the 30% number, between 20 and 30% of your hands, and if you're playing less than that, you're not playing enough, and you're playing more, you're playing too many. But really, each tournament is an animal to itself, and there may be times where you're picking up aces and kings and ace-king and pocket pairs and whatever, and it looks like, oh my god, I'm playing 60% of my hands, but those hands dictated you playing that many. But yeah, as a general rule, I think if it's somewhere between 20 and 30%, you're doing okay. And if you're playing less than that, you probably should reconsider the style that you're playing, and if you're playing more than that, then you better be damn good, or you're gonna come out on the losing end, too.
Very good strategy. Very good strategy. You know who else gives good strategy, Chris, besides you?
No, who's that?
Our good folks at GreatPokerHands.com.
Yes.
And they are going to help Len out here by sending them a wonderful set of Texas Hold'em strategy cards. So, Len, you can use those to help improve your game. And look at them and figure out what hands on there that are not quite premium, but premium enough that you're folding now, and start playing those.
Absolutely. Well, last week, part 17 of our ride-along with Columbo, the blinds were 1,000, 2,000 with a 250 ante. We had a stack of 27 grand, and there were about five or six tables left, folded around to us on the button with 9-9. I hate that hand. He wants to know, do we shove or raise 2.5x to 5,000? And if we do the 2,500 x raise, do we? What do we do if someone pushes over the top, Scott?
All right. Well, I think this is an interesting dilemma because he's asking us whether we're going to shove or raise 2.5x to 5 grand.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go out on a limb and say I think Columbo is going to raise the 2.5x to 5 grand. But but that's not the question right now.
Yeah.
And you know, I had the same situation. I was playing in a tournament down my South Florida trip. And I had the same hand, 9-9, and I shoved with a stack that's probably in the same relative range that we are here. A guy thought about it for a while, but called me with ace-king, spiked a king, boom, I was gone.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't necessarily think it was the wrong move at that time. But here, again, I just don't see a reason to overshove.
No, I know.
You know, we got 27K. Yeah. You know, if we make this 2.5 or 3 x-rays... you know, we'll do what we need to do. And if someone shoves behind me, at that point, I don't have any problem calling with 9-9 if somebody thinks they're going to play back at me because I'm making a loose button raise. But you know, I just don't see much upside to the shoving here.
Well, you pretty much just took away everything I wanted to say.
Oh, sorry, buddy.
I would definitely raise, I guess, 2.5, 3x. I mean, I would probably make it 3x, but whatever. And then, same as you, if somebody shoves, I call with 9-9. I mean... because of the position I'm in, it looks like I'm just trying to steal the blinds, doing a standard button raise with an ace rag, when actually I have a quality pair for that position, and I would definitely call an all-in behind me. And that's just because I think I'm merely stealing, and I'm not. So that's just the way it goes.
Well, the weird thing about a shove here, too, I think, is it almost looks a little more desperate. I mean, I know there's fold equity and all kinds of crazy math stuff, and definitely if you go to the forum, indiamagazine.com/forum, our mathies are out in the full force there.
Yeah.
And they all say shove because of the fold equity. And I'm going to add a special note. If anybody knows of any good hobbies, please let our friend Rant2112 know because his very War and Peace-ish posts on this are going to be legendary. But, you know, shoving, I just don't know. I think you're more like, there's a weird way of saying it. I think you're more likely to get called by hands that are marginal and can knock you out by shoving than if you just raised a 5x and fold. I mean, at this point, I don't want to get any more. I'm fine taking the blinds here.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I don't really want to get into a war with somebody with pocket nines. Maybe I'm wrong in saying that, but.
Well, you know, again, I think it takes it all into consideration, and if especially if I have the reputation of raising all the time on the button when it gets to me for first action, and they're going to just think I'm just doing it with any two cards because I'm stealing. So in that case, they're probably doing it without a pair, and if they are doing it with a pair, they're probably doing it with something lower than nines, because if they had something better than nines, they might want to trap me. So if they shove all in, I can't imagine them doing it with aces or kings, because... or yeah. Queens or whatever. So I really like my nines here, and I wouldn't shove, but I would call a shove because of the circumstances. And
yeah.
I have a good hobby for Rant2112. He could collect spoons of the Mid-Atlantic states.
Oh, excellent.
That'll keep him busy for a while.
Well played, well played.
All right, well, let's hear what happens in part 17 and then move on to part 18.
Greetings, this is Columbo from PokerWannabe.blogspot.com, and welcome to episode 18 of Ride Along with Columbo. If you recall, we are on the button with 9-9, and we're first to act. Okay, here's the plan. I'm going to raise to 5K using just the chips I need to accomplish the pressure. I also want to look tentative because I intend to call a reshove with my pair, hopefully against a hand like Ace-3 suited, and I have a plan for the hand. If I get called... when he checks the flop, I intend to shove and push him on the pot if there is only one overcard. If he shoves on the flop, I'll evaluate. He indeed makes the call, and we see a flop of 7 of clubs, 2 of diamonds, king of clubs. And he does shove all in. I didn't expect that, and now I'm forced to make a choice.
This would be a big call.
We have equal-sized stacks, and this is a big decision. Call? Or fold and play with the remaining 22K I have.
Don't you ever get tired? Tired of constantly getting the red carpet treatment?
Good evening.
Tired of having all your worries taken care of and knowing that there's a place reserved for you?
Right this way, sir.
Of course you don't. That's why you join PokerStars. After all, our VIP club awards over $3.6 million worth of major on- and offline tournament entries every month. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP to find out more about why other reward schemes just don't open as many doors. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
All right, so Scott, I had a wonderful conversation with Kevin Schaffel earlier in the month, and anyone who subscribes to our magazine can pretty much read the story and learn a lot more details than what's in this. Because, you know, the interview went really long. It went like an hour long. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's a great guy. And I just really, like, you know, we talked earlier in the show, I really think that he can pull it off. He's got such a level head and a great grasp of the game. And he knows how to go deep in big events. And obviously, you know, it's none bigger than this event. So, you know, he talks a lot about his run during the main event and a really good hand with Antonio Esfandiari. So without further ado, here's my interview with Kevin Schaffel. All right, so how did you get your start in poker?
I started playing when I was 11 in home games with friends.
Wow.
And, you know, played a little bit through my teens and played a little bit in college. And when I got out of college and I started working in the family business, I started playing in home games. The home games basically continued up until about two or three years ago, uh-huh, when one of the guys moved to Las Vegas. And I started playing tournaments about 5 years ago. That's it. That's how I started.
So when you say you played home games when you were 11, were you playing for money or just learning the game then?
No, we were playing for quarters. You know.
Wow.
Yeah. We were playing quarter, probably 25 cents, 50 cents.
Now, when did you get first introduced to hold'em? Because I know a lot of people who played when they were younger didn't really know what hold'em was on the East Coast. And was hold'em always a part of it, or did that only come when you started playing tournaments?
You know, I don't remember when I started playing hold'em, but I know that most of the home games were mixed games. And,
yeah.
And... yeah, I really don't remember when I started playing hold'em. It's been a while, but I just don't remember when and how, you know.
Is it your favorite game now, or do you have a pet game that you like?
Yeah, it would be my favorite.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you brought up the family business. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the business, what it was, and how hard it was to finally shut down after all that time?
It was a business that my father started in 1952, and I really had no intentions of ever getting into it. Uh-huh. And I graduated in 1979 with an education degree, more like a sports education or leisure activities is what it was called, and never really thought I was going to get into it, but the job market wasn't so great for what I was looking to do.
Right.
when I graduated, and I started in sales, and, you know, I had some success, especially after about 6 months. And I could see that I could never make that kind of money in my chosen profession or in the profession that I studied in. And I just stayed in it. That was in 1979. And then in 1986, I ended up buying it from him and his partner, my father and his partner.
Wow.
And, been in it ever since.
Now, how hard was it to let it go, to know that, you know, you lost your love for it or your desire to do it anymore and you wanted to move on? Was it a difficult decision?
You know, the hardest part was, and it's a long story, I'm going to make it real simple. I had a partner for like the last 9 years.
Okay.
And I had about 22 employees, and he came in one day and decided to open up his own business without any knowledge of mine. And he took half the business with him. So I was stuck with half the amount of business with the same amount of employees because he didn't take any of them.
Wow.
So it was hard to maintain, you know, the numbers just didn't work. You know, I couldn't afford to keep them all. So the hardest part of shutting down the business was because I had to do it in two steps. I actually shut down the business as I knew it about 5 years ago when I just started brokering. You know, yeah. I just kept doing the sales, but I subcontracted all the work out, but I had to get rid of all the employees. I was lucky enough to come across another company that needed or that was looking for like a mailing company to enhance his printing company.
Right.
And he was able to hire a lot of the people, so it made it so much easier for me, you know. I think I was able to hire or get jobs for almost everybody except one person.
Wow.
So that made it a lot easier for me. That was the hardest day of my life in my business life.
Wow.
Was walking in one day and telling everybody that our company was shutting down. I mean, I literally was crying. I mean, it was really tough.
God.
And, you know, but once that day was over, and I knew that a lot of the people were going to have jobs, you know, it made it a lot easier for me. And it was actually the best thing that ever happened in, you know, from a financial standpoint, because I was able to make more money by brokering than I was by running the business myself.
Right.
At the end.
Right.
So, and then that company moved. The company I was doing all my work with, they moved to South Carolina, and I was still doing business with them.
Wow.
But obviously it's a little difficult, you know, doing business with somebody in South Carolina when you were used to driving around the block to do business with
them. Yeah.
So that worked for a few years, though, and I did lose my passion for the job. I never, you know, there's no question I wasn't, like, thrilled with what I was doing. And I said to myself, you know, it's been 30 years, almost 30 years. And, you know, this is the time, you know, business. And this is really before the business started, like the economy really started going south.
Right.
So it would have probably gone out of business on its own just okay. based on, you know, the economy.
Yeah.
But I was probably a few months ahead of it being really bad. And, you know, obviously it's worked out for the
now,
best.
How did you arrive at the decision to play poker? Now, I think I've read a few things about you already where you have been record of saying you're semi-professional. You wouldn't really consider you're a professional yet. How did you arrive at that? And were you financially sound enough where it wouldn't be a lot of pressure, or did you have a lot of pressure on yourself to succeed?
I've been playing probably four or five, I would say for the last 10 years, I would make like four or five times a year, I would travel out to California or Vegas.
Right.
And I would make them like, you know, when I had the business, they'd be 5 day trips. And then once I went out on my own and I started brokering and I didn't need to be there every day, the trips turned into 7 day trips or 9 day trips.
Right.
And I realized the more I didn't need to be there, you know, the longer I could stay away and play. And I just, you know, I always had some success. More than some success, I was always very successful playing. And then a year ago, February in 08, I just decided to, you know, make it a monthly deal. And so I basically planned a trip every month. And
yeah.
I would stay away for like 12 or 13 days, you know, almost
yeah.
half the month. And I would just play a lot of cards. I mean, a lot of cards, 15, 16, 18 hours a day.
Because wow.
that's what I was out there to do.
Right.
I wanted to try to simulate as close as I could what it would be like to play 40 hours a week, but unfortunately I had to squeeze it into 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I played a lot of hours, which never really bothered me, but now that I've done it, it would be so much better if it was in my backyard.
Right.
And, you know, if you were having a bad day after 4 or 5 hours, you could go home, you could, you know, go to the gym, you could go to the golf course, you could do so many other things.
Yeah.
When I was out there, I basically just played. And,
yeah.
you know, it was tough when you were going through some bad streaks, you know, knowing that you just had to keep playing. So, I'm looking forward to the day they get a higher stakes poker in Florida, and I don't have to travel as much, and I'm going to be able to do it on my own schedule and not on, you know, not because I feel like I have to.
Was it rough to get through
right.
a bad patch like that?
Well, I mean, it got to be. I mean, it's documented, and I've stated it before that I never ran so bad in my life leading up to the World Series. I mean, started around January, and I just never had experienced what it was like to run that bad. I mean, for not just for hours, but for days, and then for weeks, and then it was pretty rough, you know. But I maintained my cool as best I could. I'm not saying I did all the time, but I maintained and tried to limit my losses. In fact, I credit my success in this year's World Series to the bad streak that I had, because like my friend said, he says, who would have ever thought that you running so bad for so many months would have helped you, you know, just keep throwing away bad hands after bad hands after bad hands and not feeling pressured to play a hand that you shouldn't be playing. And I was 100% in agreement with him. You know, it got to the point where I was just so used to throwing hands away. Like, I hear people say all the time after like 30 minutes or 45 minutes, Jesus, I haven't had a hand for an hour, you know, and I want to just say, well, try 14 hours or try 3 days and see how you feel. So, I mean, I definitely think it helped me, and there's no question it helped me.
How much has this final table meant to you, you know, making this choice and for your family, your kids in college and things like that?
Well, it's unbelievable. I mean, the fact that, I mean, I just was at my golf club and one of the guys and I were just talking. He says, can you believe, that 20 people from the golf club are coming out to watch you? You know, forget about the 50 or the 70 or the 80 family and close friends, you know, that I knew were coming out. But no, it's just unbelievable. But not that a lot of people need an excuse to go to Vegas, by the way. I mean, right. You know, I'm not so sure how many of them wouldn't have wanted to go anyway.
Right.
But no, it's been an unbelievable experience. And, you know, I keep saying no matter what happens, it's been great, and I'm as happy as can be. Of course, I want to do as well as I can do once I'm out there.
Right.
But to have all my family and friends out there when it happens is just going to be great.
You know,
and financial part of it is just a bonus. I mean,
right.
You know, it's not like I was broke. I don't want anybody. There have been some articles written, you know, down on my luck and out, you know, and this and that. You know, I wasn't broke, and I wasn't close to, you know.
Right.
To that point, but no, it's a beautiful thing, and I'm gonna be able to buy a house, and I'm gonna, you know, because I've been divorced for about 4 years, and so, you know, we have to split that up, and it's just gonna be nice, and there'll be a little something extra for the kids at, you know, at the end of the day down the road. So
now we talked about the final table. Given the competition and really what's at stake, Have you spent your time preparing for it, or are you going in saying, hey, this is what got me here, and this is what I'm going to play?
You know, I'm a little torn because, you know, obviously I'm going to watch all the shows, and I'm going to watch how they play, but I don't know how you can simulate, you know, that experience or the situation. I mean, I can play sit and goes, but, you know, no sit and go is going to have Darvin Moon with the third of the chips.
Yeah.
And no sit and go is going to put me in sixth place, you know. And there's just no way to simulate it. I'm playing cash games. You know, I played a tournament at the Legends, and I'm going to London, and I'm going to play. I think just playing, just having, you know, cards in front of me is all I'm going to do. You know, I contemplated briefly having a coach, but you know, I'm not, I just don't think that's the way to go for me. I don't want to overthink things. You know, may be good for somebody, but, you know, I've been playing a long time, and I kind of have a sense as to what I need to do. And I'd hate at the end of the day for some, you know, for me to think, Jesus Christ, my coach told me to do this, or we talked about this, but my gut told me to do something else. And, you know, I just, I just have a bad, you know, not a bad feeling. I'd love to talk to people about being at the final table, but I don't know if I want to hire a coach to like get specifics, you know, specifically into details as to what I should do. And I think things change so much at the final table based on who doubles up and who doesn't. And I just don't know if I can, you know, I just don't think I want to go there.
I looked at your tournament record, too. I mean, it's pretty incredible how well you've done. And I don't think it has anything to do with the bad streak you were on before either, because obviously a lot of your caches came before that as well. Why do you think you're so successful in these high buy-in big tournaments? I mean, it's like a 50% caching rate at least. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I really don't know why. I mean, I actually do have an opinion on it, but I really don't want to say because I think you know, I think I have an opinion as to why I do better than some others. Because actually, for a long time, I felt like I really wasn't that lucky. I mean, there were a couple of World Series where, I mean, I got it in with the best of it almost every time, and that's how I got knocked out. And that happens to a lot of people, I know.
Right.
But it just seemed like it was happening a lot. Like from 04 to 07, there was no success. But it seemed like every time I got knocked out of a tournament, I had the best of it. I mean, I have some ideas as to why I do better, but I just don't want to get into specifics on that right now.
Okay.
We can talk on like November 11th, and I'll be happy to answer any of those questions.
All right, so then tell me a little bit about your path to the final table. Were you ever all in for your tournament life, and were there any memorable, crucial hands that you can remember or want to talk about?
Yeah, sure. There were two very memorable hands to me. The first one is we got to go all the way back to day one.
Wow.
I lost 5,000 in the first round, first level. So I'm down to 25,000 after 2 hours.
Wow.
And 5 minutes into level two, I get pocket tens in the big blind, and the button raises, comes around to the button, and he raises, and he'd raised, you know, every time before on the button, so right. It was no surprise, and I have pocket tens, and I just call, and the flop comes 8-10 jack with two to a suit.
Right.
So I didn't want to give him any free cards, so I let out, and he raised me pretty big.
Wow.
And I re-raised all in. I didn't want to mess around with the hand. You know, I didn't want to give him a free card. And he insta-called me.
Oh, no.
So I said, oh boy. And he turns over 7-9.
He
flopped a straight. Okay?
Oh my God.
But what's really strange, Chris, is that like I carried his bag with me with all my stuff, you know, my iPod, my jacket, my water, whatever. And in the past, I would just like be like ready to leave. Go to pick my bag up and just stand up and ready to leave. And there was something about it that I just was very calm, and I kind of knew the board was going to pair. And a four comes on the turn, no help at all. And I just sat there still, and the board paired the jack on the river.
Wow.
And I got to 50,000, and, you know, three hands later, I was at 100,000, or five hands later, I was at 100,000, you know.
Jeez.
And I never looked back. But obviously, that was very fortunate. But the hand played itself, both sides. He's raising on the button with any two cards, this particular guy, and got lucky enough to flop a straight while I flop a set. So there's no chance that the money's not going in at any point, whether it was the flop or the turn. I got lucky to, you know, to win the hand. And I never looked back. I was in the top probably 1% or 2% the entire tournament. And to my knowledge, I don't think I was ever all in where the hands were turned up at the end. I may have gone all in late, like on day 8 or 9, but I don't think I was ever at jeopardy with, you know, with the hands up. In fact, I know I wasn't.
Wow.
The other real interesting hand, which I'm most proud of how I handled it, is the most fun I ever had at the table was with Antonio Sfondiari. what a good guy he is, and I can't wait to see him again. But he was on my left one day, and it's like day three. He's been raising me all day, and if he doesn't raise me, he calls me like to my left. So
right.
I just got up to like 500,000 or 450 or something, a big number in day three. And he's got about 250. And I get king nine of diamonds, one from the button. And he's on the button. And I raise to 6,000. Of course, he makes it 18,000, which I fully expected. And the flop comes king three, two. And I check, and he bets. But he only bets like 22.5 into like a pot of like 45,000. Uh-huh. And I check raise him to 60,000. So I raise him 37.5. And he thinks about it for a few minutes, and then he decides to min raise me to 75,000. So he only raises me 37.5. I mean, a legitimate min raise, which left him 58,000. And I thought about it for a long time. The cameras are rolling, and, you know, and I said, geez, you know, I'm going to be down to 300,000. If I lose the hand, I'll be up to about 600 if I win. But, you know, I just don't like my kicker. I mean, there's a lot of things I could be beat by. I could be beat by aces, ace, king, you know, whatever. So I lay it down, and he says, Kevin, you're not going to like this, but only because the cameras are rolling. And he turns over queen jack offsuit. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, there's only about, I don't know, one player, him,
yeah.
who would have done something like that. Here, you know, it's bad enough that I check raise him. It's like, okay, just throw your hand away, and you still got about 100,000 left, and just, you know, be happy you still got chips left, right? No, he decides to min raise me. And he left himself with about 58,000 in chips in case I pushed all in on him, which obviously he couldn't call.
Right.
But that was the beauty of the play, you know. And I just took it so well. I congratulated him. I said, nice play. I patted him on the back. I think I can't wait to see the hand and see how I reacted. But my reaction to the hand was what I was so proud about because, you know, I didn't get upset. I didn't let it bother me. Didn't put me on tilt. And in the past, you know, stuff like that would really have bothered me. But, you know, I acknowledge a really nice play.
Well, I really appreciate your time, Kevin. I wish you the best of luck. I hope you take it down, and I hope everything happens for you. And
well, I appreciate it. You know, you're the third person that hopes I take it down. That's me, you, and my ex. There's three of us. I know of three people that are hoping that I take it down.
Oh, man.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go. Downtown.
This is Downtown Chad Brown, and I'm in the studio with Anti Up.
Chris, our old buddy Lee is back in the house.
I think he had swine flu.
Oh, maybe.
I haven't seen him and heard from him in weeks.
Wow, no. Lee, was it swine flu, or did we just upset you?
What's happening, guys? No swine flu. Just been playing a lot and working on some training material and all that stuff.
Awesome.
Excellent. Well, working on training material has jogged my memory that since the last time you were on, we've gotten a couple emails from our listeners that want to know a little bit more about AcumenPoker.net. You're a great training program, so don't dominate the show here, buddy, but give us the Cliff's Notes on what our listeners can learn from you if they decide to hire you.
Sure. Well, you guys know I started doing some teaching with the World Poker Tour boot camps, and then I kind of branched out. I still teach with them, but I also formed my own company where I do group and individual-based trainings. I'm actually probably going to have a group training coming up in January. And what I do is I focus a lot. It's mostly geared towards tournaments, but really focus a lot on situational poker. A lot of the concepts we talk about when we're doing the hands of the week are things that are pretty prevalent in my training classes. But what I do is, I mean, I'm constantly learning and implementing new things into my game, and so my classes evolve. Actually, most of the people that come to one tend to come to the next ones that I have, but I do these group trainings, and then I also do quite a bit of individual coaching and individual lessons, so people can just contact me if they want more information on that.
Okay, and they can go to acumenpoker.net to do that, correct?
Yep, that's great.
Excellent. And also, we should always mention that Lee is also one of the great pros at Lock Poker.
That's right.
And all right, let's jump into a hand here, buddy. Let's see whether you're worth hiring.
All right, sounds good.
All right, this hand comes from Ryrie, all the way in Portland, Oregon, Chris.
That doesn't sound like a name. That sounds like Astro from the Jetsons saying something.
Hey, I say, you know, I'm going to rename myself Ryrie. I love it.
It's a Astro Ryrie. Sorry.
All right. So he is he or she, I guess I should say, didn't give us a sex here. Who do you think Ryrie would be?
It's a guy.
It's a guy? You sure?
Yeah, I think it's a guy.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, it's a guy today then. It says it's he's playing a dime quarter with a nickel ante cash game online at a online site that will remain nameless.
Wow, nickel ante, huh?
Yeah, kind of an interesting game. I haven't seen that before. Have you seen that, Lee, with a forced ante?
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, I've seen they've added those on some of the sites, and it's pretty interesting. Definitely makes the games play a lot different. They've been doing a lot of tournaments with antes from the beginning also, so it makes the game play a lot differently.
Does it make it play bigger? Is that the idea?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. All right. He says he has no specific information on his villain here, and his general view of him, though, is that he's capable of calling pre-flop weakly, and he's a little passive, so anything unexpected should be dealt with cautiously. All right, so that's our setup, and we ante, and we get the Queen of Diamonds, Ace of Hearts, and we are under the gun. This is a six-handed table, by the way, too.
Okay, am I supposed to go first?
I will invite somebody to start talking.
It's been a long time since Lee's been on the show. I couldn't remember if I need to act first or have him talk first. But since it's six-handed, okay. I'm definitely going to raise with this hand. If it was a full table in a tournament and I was, you know, wasn't deep or whatever, I would probably fold it. But six-handed, that's like under the gun plus three in a real table or whatever. So I'm definitely raising probably 3.5x with this just because there's antes out there too.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm certainly raising it. Whenever I see Ace Queen, my first inclination is just to tell people to fold it because I think if most people just didn't play Ace Queen or Ace Jack or Ace Ten, they'd be much better off. But of course, at a six max table, your first act there, you're in mid to late position anyway, so you're definitely going to raise whatever the standard raise has been. So if it's 3x, 4x, 5x, whatever that is, make your standard raise.
All right, well, Hero raises to $1.25, which is, 5x, if I do the math quickly.
Yeah.
And it folds around to the big blind who calls. So we've got heads up, head to the flop of deuce of clubs, seven of hearts, ace of spades, and the big blind checks.
Well, I mean, you got to find out what he's calling with. You got to bet something here. I don't think he should check here. I want to find out where I am. So I don't know. I'd probably bet. What's in the pot now? Probably about 270, maybe 280 or so. Probably.
Maybe yeah, 285.
Two quarter plus the antes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I would probably bet about 175 here. Maybe $2.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and I'm betting whether I hit this flop or didn't hit this flop. I mean, I'm just going to make my continuation bet heads up against the blind here. And at this point, I mean, I like my hand and I actually want to build a pot. You got to figure you've got the best hand. And, I mean, the only things that could beat you are the sets or ace-seven, ace-deuce. So, of course, seven-deuce, which is highly unlikely. But
you never know.
Should be in good shape. That's true.
I can't tell you how many ass clowns I've seen play seven deuce for the fun of it, but all right. Well, our hero bets $2 into this pot, and he gets repopped to $5.50. What does this tell us now?
Well, check raise in this situation. I mean, there's no draw there. It's not like he has 3-4 and he's drawn to a wheel. So, I mean, my inclination is that he hit two pair, doesn't believe us, or has a set. So. Does he not believe us? I don't know. I mean, they're deep stacked too, right? You were saying before they're like deep.
Let's see. Our villain has $42, and we have $45, so about the same. Yeah. So yeah, very deep stacked.
I think I'm beat. I mean, I can't imagine a check raise. It's not a flush draw check raise. There's no flush out there, and it's not a straight draw check raise. So it seems like he's hit it really hard and his check raising us, or he has nothing. So at this point, I don't know if I know this player well enough to know that he's just beating up on my continuation bet here. I may fold or just call and see what the turn brings, but I may fold.
Yeah, I think I'm going to call here. I agree. I mean, I don't like the check raise. If he has a really strong hand, the check raise is kind of silly. People kind of misuse the check raise a lot when they have really strong hands. You know, if you're the villain here, you've got to assume that our hero is going to continuation bet pretty much 100% of the time. So if you actually nailed this flop, it'd be kind of silly to check raise. If I'm in the villain's spot, you know, in his spot, I would rather check raise with complete air, especially since there's no draws out there. You know, if I had a set on a draw heavy board, I might lead. I might check raise to make him think that I'm on a draw. But I'm as in the hero spot, I'm not ready to give up yet. But just because complete air or any pairs below an ace are, I think, in his range, and he could just be check raising to see if we're just c-betting light here.
Well, and Lee, you mentioned that, putting yourself back in the hero spot then. If we're not really sold on this check raise from our opponent, would there be a case to be made to re-raise here to kind of find out for sure?
No, I'm not going to, because, I mean, what you'll find out is if he's just willing to put more money in the pot. I mean, he could be crazy and go nuts with ace jack, ace 10, ace 9, ace 8. You know, I mean, there's a lot of hands that he may be willing to play a big pot with that don't actually have us beat. And, you know, and that may be okay that we fold a better hand, but there's no need to get into, you know, playing this gigantic pot with just your one pair right now. So you're deep enough here that there's, you know, I'm certainly not wanting to get my whole stack in here with just a pair. Right. So yeah, I'm fine just calling the 350 here and then seeing how it develops.
Okay. The hero does its call, and we go to a turn, which is the king of diamonds. So the board is deuce of clubs, seven of hearts, ace of spades, king of diamonds, and the big blind checks now.
It just does not feel like he check-raised with a draw, so if it was complete air and he's afraid, that's what it feels like, but he could also be tricky. You know, he could have a big hand and he's just setting you up. I think I'll check to keep the size of the pot a decent size here.
Absolutely. My plan is to... I would check and then I'd probably call a bet on the river, most likely.
Yeah.
Depending on what it is.
Now, Lee, I've seen this before where somebody does a check raise twice. Do you see that often at all?
Yeah, people do that, you know, and it just, if you don't have a really strong hand, then don't think they were just check raising you with nothing. I actually saw it in a live tournament I was playing, and a guy who I know and respect pretty well was able to check raise a guy successfully on the flop turn and river. The guy just kept betting. Like it was hilarious. And I think I think my friend had pocket aces on the hand, and the guy didn't make his hand until the river. He hit like one pair on the river.
Wow.
So it was, yeah, it's if you're in Ryrie's spot here, I'm certainly checking. You're way ahead or way behind right here, and you know, like, you know, it's the check raise is such a powerful thing, and it's usually super strong or it's air, you know. So and you don't know at this point what it is, so you might as well just check. You just got one pair here, and just like Chris said, just keep the pot a little smaller.
Okay. Well, our hero checks as instructed by our experts here. And we see a river card of the ace of diamonds. So the board is deuce of clubs, seven of hearts, ace of spades, king of diamonds, ace of diamonds. I got to think we like this card. Until the big blind bets out, 775.
Well, here's the thing, and I don't know if this will sound right to you guys or not, but to me, the ace doesn't change anything. I mean, it really doesn't, because if this guy had me crushed, then he's only improved to a boat if he had two pair. you know, unless his two pair were twos and sevens, which we said, you know, deuces and sevens, which we totally just, you know, discounted that. So I don't see how that ace helps us, really. I mean, it gives us, it improves one of our kickers, but we still have to play the queen. Right. And if we were beat, we're still beat, unless he had deuce seven, which he didn't have. He just know he didn't have that. So I guess I'd be inclined to just call that bet and not get crazy and raise here. I mean, there's no way I have the best hand if he had any of that flop earlier and bets into me now. So I feel like I should just call here. I don't think I should raise.
Yeah, I'm never raising in this spot. And I think a lot of people mistakenly would. You know, you're only going to get called by a worse hand if it's maybe a, you know, ace jack or lower that obviously is not ace seven or ace deuce. And if he's got any of those sets there, you're in big trouble there, and you don't want to raise here and then fold to a re-raise.
Yeah.
Because ace jack and ace 10 and ace 9, those hands are probably gonna feel like their best. So, you know, really, really any ace is going to feel like they've got the best hand at this point, from the villain's perspective, especially since you checked on the turn. So, yeah, I'm just calling here.
If he just calls here, I mean, there was really no point to put this on the air. Let's just end the Hand of the Week segment right now. Because, I mean, we didn't do anything different than what he did, and we both agreed the whole way, so... let's hope he re-raises or something and we can go, Baja! Because otherwise it's like, you know, what's the point of this hand?
All right, well, hold that thought there, Chris.
Okay.
As I try to salvage this hand by saying I'm interested more in how the villain has played this hand. Of course, we'll get to what happens here in a minute. But I'm really curious as to someone who would call a under-the-gun raise, check raise on the flop, and then check the turn, and then bet big on the river. It's a weird sequence of bets, I think. Am I wrong?
Well, it's either really he's really, really sneaky, or he's desperate on the end here. So it's either he's really sneaky and has a massive hand like a boat, or he's desperate to try to make you fold your hand, and he's betting an amount that seems to me like he wants you to fold, but looks like he wants to call, so he's trying the higher level of thinking here. So it's either a monster or it's Aaron. He's hoping you to fold on the end there with that bet.
Yeah, I mean, but it could be any other ace as well. That's the thing. That's still a huge part of his range there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very consistent with any other ace that he might check raise you with kind of a weaker ace. And then when you still called, he might, you know, the person might say, uh-oh, maybe he's actually got a hand. And so he checks the turn, and you check behind, and now the ace hits on the river, so now he's betting for value. So
yeah.
You can't say that you're definitely beat here, that it's, I think that it's a monster or error, even though those are in the range as well. But because of the fact that just any other ace that doesn't have that kicker paired is also in his range, you know, I definitely want to just call here, but... you know, so I think there's value in the way that the hero is playing it. Let's see what he does, because I think if he does just call here, there's some value as far as the hand of the week as to the way he played it, and then we can look at what the villain, you know, how he played whatever he has.
Thanks there, buddy Lee. I appreciate you saving me there. the hero does call here, and at showdown loses the hand. Our villain had deuce of hearts, deuce of diamonds, flopped a set, turned into a full house on the river. All right, Lee, so you started to save me there. Continue to pull me out of the water here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important when you're analyzing hands. A lot of people look, you know, I get emails from people all the time, you know, asking about hands, and, you know, from my students, and it's usually, what did I do wrong here? One of the things to really take away is look at hands that are played well. And I think our hero played this hand really well and exercised some pot control. Only lost $12, where a lot of people lose $42 on this hand or whatever the villain had at the beginning. So, you know, when you definitely are going to raise it pre-flop. You're going to c-bet when you hit your ace. He check raises you. Again, just because his range is so wide, It doesn't have to be an ace or a set. You know, I mean, it would have to be ace king to have you beat, or ace seven or ace deuce, or a set to have you beat at this point. So I wouldn't give up on the hand. The king comes and he checks to you after check raising you. Might as well just check it. You know, he could have had ace king the whole time, and he could have those sets or the two pair, like we said. So check it. And then when we hit our ace there and he fires, it's consistent with any other ace and the other hands we've talked about. So just calling there is the right thing to do, because you're only going to get value if he happens to have that ace with the lower kicker that didn't pair the board. So by calling, you get to see what he has, and you also minimize any other further damage to your stack if he actually did have you beat. From the villain's perspective, you know, I really don't like the check raise on such a dry board. This board can't get any drier for a set of deuces with ace, right, seven, deuce, rainbow. There's no draw whatsoever, other than the gut shot that you just virtually rule out from your hero's range. He doesn't have 3-4. Or, you know, I mean, that's, yeah, just, or something, or a 5-4. So, you know, I think I would check call if I'm the hero, I mean, the villain in this spot, and just hope that he has an ace and he's going to continue. I mean, I think most aces are going to continue on the turn, because they're not going to think you have ace king. They're going to feel really good. And I think, you know, I typically don't slow play sets, but at a position when you're not the preflop aggressor, I think the best way for him to get the most value is to check, call, and then probably lead the river. You could try to check raise the river, really hoping he has an ace, but I think the villain kind of played it. It's not really awful, but, you know, once he check raises and the guy still calls, he might as well go ahead and lead the turn, right, and you're just hoping that the original raiser has ace king or ace queen and can't let it go.
Well, I got a question for you.
Sure.
What about betting into him when you have that set? Because that's like a super system axiom where, you know, if you flop a set into a pre-flop raiser and an ace comes, you know, he always says bet into the guy because he likely has ace queen or ace king, hit his hand and won't get away from it from at least another bet. So if you bet into him, he's going to call or raise you, and you'll get paid off with your sets that way.
Yeah, I like doing that, especially in multi-way pots or if there's a draw present, because people will assign you more of a wider range. Heads up, on such a dry board, I'm going to hope to at least get the continuation bet out of him.
Uh-huh.
And because most of the, if you lead into him and he doesn't have an ace, then he may just go away. And you want to at least get that C bet out of him if he has, you know, I mean, his range is anything reasonable or unreasonable at the point that you're at the flop. You know, I mean, he can have literally any two cards. And I expect him to C bet. So I think my best way of getting value in this spot, as the villain, would be to check, get the C bet if he, and he should C bet it, and then you call that, and then check the turn. If he doesn't fire there, then you fire the river, and then at that point I think if he has an ace, if he plays it that way, then if the hero was slow playing an ace, by not c-betting it, you might get a lot of money in on the river. So yeah, you're right. I mean, it's, you should lead with sets a pretty high percentage of the time, but I think in this spot on such a dry board, I think the best way to get more money in the pot is at least checking the flop. But check raising, you're just going to drive out anybody that didn't hit. You know,
yeah,
you're gonna lose two queens or two jacks or, you know, and those kind of hands. So if you just check call, you know, he may put you on a mid pair or just a seven, you know, something like a suited 7-8, or, you know, your range is just much wider.
All right, so Scott, tell him what he won.
All right, Ryrie, we will send you a wonderful $10 online staking package from Get a Stake. www.pokerstars.com. That will help with your online game. And other folks, send us your hands of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And it looks like one just came in for Lee. And if Lee's around, he'll analyze it. If not, Chris and I will flounder over it. But send it to podcast@antiupmagazine.com either way.
All right. Excellent. Hey, Lee, thanks for coming back. We're glad you're healthy again.
All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. Another good show. Scott, I'm Chris Costanza. Who are you?
I am Scott Long.
And we'll see you at the table.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.